Session number 21564, Reel 21.
Colonel Cormac, Reel 21. You were saying that the main types of helicopter the Army had at that time were the small helicopters used for scouting and reconnaissance and liaison.
And a few Chinooks. Because from my own point of view, I was interested in mobility of bridging equipment. And the new medium girder bridge was just coming in.
Would that be a replacement for the Bailey Bridge?
It was a replacement for the family of Bailey Bridge, which finished up as the heavy girder bridge, which demanded large cranes to lift and operate parts of it. The Bailey Bridge could all be manhandled. And the idea was, and we did some trials, of lifting complete medium girder bridges. That was the original size, which would be about 30 metres long, say, that you could build the bridge, the idea, build the bridge somewhere else and then lift it and drop it onto the gap without too much preparation. So I had that sort of knowledge, from what I'd seen films of it and so on and demonstrations, to offer to assist mobility in the field, that we could actually place a bridge quickly and it would be as good, if not better, than the tank bridge layer, which was the other way of getting bridging across the field, particularly under fire conditions. But all these things were being talked about. What could we do? How would we organize them? What would the gunners do? The gunners wanted to know how they could move their 25-pounders or the equivalent, the
105.
The 105 gun. Yes, how they could move that quickly. Could they do it by helicopter? All these were thoughts that we were doing and trying out and so on. And again, the Armoured Corps representative would be interested as much on the reconnaissance side of the thing. And with the infantry there, we all talked about the requirements and just built up some ideas. Under Glenn Gilbert's leadership, we published this small pamphlet as a first cockshy, if you like. It was just interesting to be involved.
And another question about helicopters is who should operate them, because the RAF would obviously have an interest in retaining control of aircraft, particularly above a certain capacity.
There was always that dichotomy between the Army and the Air Force. Not far away at RAF Odium was, I think, their main helicopter base. It may still be, for all I know. But they were much involved in air sea rescue and that sort of practical work, as among other things, and liaison and moving groups about. The Army Air Corps was in its fledgling days. At that time, the commandant of the Army Air Corps, Army Aviation, was always an ex-parachutist, not necessarily now. And in fact, quite a few sappers have run Army Aviation quite successfully. But that was just, again, building up what sort of role would they have, what responsibilities should they have. And the RAF had their own views on that sort of organisation, and indeed they had the helicopters. They had the bigger ones.
The heavy lift.
Heavy lift and also carrying more people, the troop carrying ones.
Did they have the Wessex at that time?
Yes, that was a name I remember. Later on I used them in Ireland.
Did the RAF take part in your discussions in any way, and did they take part in your training for heliops?
They took part in training, yes, and exercises. I don't recall them taking part, much active part, in the discussions. Possibly time, I don't know. I didn't organise who was coming along, but I don't recall too much RAF direct input into our deliberations.
You mentioned earlier on the issue of vulnerability of helicopters. Do you remember what the thinking was about that at the time?
Well, basically how easy they were to be shot down. Mm. I think that was it. Mm. And how easy the pilot and or navigator, how vulnerable they were to certain aspects of small arms fire. Certainly the Americans found that they were very, very uncomfortable flying into properly coordinated small arms fire. Low-level air defense, if you like. And I know that later on in Ireland, when I was using helicopters to control riot situations, when I had to fly above the scene and direct people on the ground to stop things, we had occasionally been hit by small arms fire, and they developed material which they could button on to the bottom of the plane, which would reduce the risk of being killed by small arms fire. So there was that era of vulnerability from that point of view. And some very fine stuff was developed. Bulletproof material. I'm trying to think what it was, Kevlar or something like that, that's a name that comes to mind, that was very effective.
Were there tactical ways in which helicopters could operate in order to reduce their vulnerability?
Yes, I mean, you were flying, and low-level flying, lap of the land, contour flying, so that you would only appear, and as long as your navigation was good, that you only appeared at certain heights under certain conditions, that you followed the ground, and that demanded fairly high standard of map reading, of course, to make sure you didn't get lost. And also, you had to beware of all the obstacles still, low-level flying, like power lines, telephone wires, and other obstacles to flying. But that was the basic thing, is you stuck close to the ground, used the reverse slopes, used wooded areas to fly around and so on to avoid being seen.
Now, the other thing about helicopters is that certainly in the early days they required an enormous amount of maintenance in order to keep them in the air and flying reliably. Presumably there were engineering implications for support, administration and
that
maintenance
was
and supply.
Administrative support, yes. And they would, of course, would have, the Rimi were much involved there.
What was the role of the engineers in giving, support to helicopters in the field?
Well, again, it was ideas and how we could be involved, and it was a mobility exercise. They were improving A, mobility, and B, hopefully, firepower at the right place at the right time. It was getting the stuff there and making sure they could use it. What a quick flip.
How was your speculative pamphlet received when you published it?
Well, it was published at Warminster. It was not an army publication as such. And I think it was quite well received. It was meant to stimulate ideas. That was all it could do. We were not trying to have a definitive book on operations at that time. But we merely wanted to put down on paper into a paperback with a sort of cardboard cover thing some notes that would be of use. And we had chapters on general use of helicopters, the infantry role, the impact of the gunner requirements, RAC, SAPR, and communications. There was a little bit about administration, but not too much at that stage, because you had to get the first part right before the second part could come in.
So what's your emphasis then really on tactical employment?
It was the tactical employment of helicopters. Enough, I think, was known at that time to ensure that whatever came at that stage, that refueling and maintenance would be available at the right time in the right place, because that had been done successfully in Borneo, to a little bit in Malaya, and was already going in BOR, but on a very limited scale. At that time, they were still forming up the Army Aviation, the Army Air Corps, because each arm had its own helicopter flights, if you like. And certainly when I went to Beer Warren exercise to get Beer Warren experience before going to Warminster, I had experience of our flight and what it could do, and it was extremely useful whizzing up and down a river bank and then saying that's the place, taking photographs from the helicopter with a Polaroid, and then I could write up for the recce report for that particular site with a map showing the place, some notes on the site, and one or two Polaroid views. But that and taking the CRE round from divisional headquarters to a brigade, when it was going, depending on what was going on, was really about the limit of what we had been doing at that time in the Corps. And then after that, they were all subsumed into the Army Air Corps under the direction of Director of Army Aviation. So that was how things built up slowly.
When you were talking about the infantry, you said that one of the primary roles was moving troops about the battlefield. At that stage, was anyone thinking in terms of using the small helicopters as aerial command posts?
Yes, that was quite a useful thing, but it came in, as I said, from my particular point of view, very much of use in places like Belfast, Lurgan, where we had, again, early days where we were changing from A to the civil power in a traditional sense, imperial policing, to a more realistic way of tackling a long-term civil disobedience, or call it what you will, in a place like Ulster, which we'll come on to later. But I certainly used it as for controlling troops on the ground. I could see mobs, as they were, the rioters, moving from place to place. Above, and I had a street plan, and I could direct people on the ground very quickly to cut them off, block them, and contain them. Things like that. Again, over certain built-up areas, being up in the air, you could spot the odd terrorist movement, IRA type or PIRA type as it was then, on rooftops or possible snipers or others who might have posed a threat to troops on the ground. So that was coming on and being used quite a bit in that sense.
But when you were initially at Warminster, were you thinking in terms of the helicopter possibly being used as a command post by a company commander in the infantry and BAOR?
No. I can't say that we went into that level at all, no. Mm. The command was structure was conventional at that time, more standard, if you like.
Mm. What were the artillery going to use the helicopter for besides trying to shift guns and ammunition? Were they going to use it for spotting?
Spotting, FOOs, yes. A link in the air, possibly moving guns very quickly from one place to the other, ready to fire, which they were pretty good at, and to match the self-propelled gun system which was coming in at that time. It was, I have to say, fairly elementary, but interesting nevertheless.
It was early days. Mm. But did you have any access to information about the way in which the Warsaw Pact countries were using their helicopters?
Not directly. We used to get the technical journal or the Tech Int journal on Warsaw Pact affairs, but through my experience in Brixmas, one knew that they used helicopters a great deal for moving troops around, and they also had armed helicopters.
They had the hip-hind combination, yes, didn't they, eventually?
They did indeed, and even in those days, that's the mid-60s, their helicopters theoretically posed quite a threat, and certainly their armed ones looked fairly menacing. Mm. In fact, there were tales later on, in I think the 70s and 80s, of mission cars being pursued by Russian helicopters as a speedy means of trying to trap them. So we were quite impressed with their stage, and they seem to have more facilities of that in that sense than we had, although the Americans were similarly equipped, of course, but we were just coming along behind.
did you incorporate helicopters into the training and the exercises done on the company commander's course?
Well, when halfway through, say my time at Warminster, the All Arms Tactics Wing was disbanded, and we reverted to platoon commanders and company commander courses, with a certain input into senior the platoon sergeant courses. But at that time, they were in place of the All Arms Tactics Wing. They set up the Junior Defence and Staff Course at Warminster. It was a time of great upheaval because they had closed the small arms wing at Hythe in Kent. They had moved that to Warminster. New ranges were being built and planned. And again, oddly enough, with the construction of the new ranges, our Clerk of Works sappers were much involved. Then, not far away, we had the support weapons wing at Netherhaven, and that wasn't too far.
That used to be in the machine gun corps, didn't it?
Machine guns, mortars, anti-tanks. Mm-hmm. I used to talk about how to deal with Warsaw Pact armour, unconventional ways, using sapper equipment, and talk to the support weapons wing at Netherhaven.
What sort of unconventional ways were those? Could you
explain?
They
were ways that we had borrowed, if you like, from the Germans, from the Wehrmacht, because they were faced in the latter stages of 1945, or the war in the 45, with a massive number of Soviet armour and a decreasing ability to stop them. And so they invented all sorts of improvisation ways, which we adapted. One of the key things was a nice film I had showing German pioneers and soldiers being trained in how to improvise anti-tank weapons using mines and explosives and other equipment like that in a slightly unconventional way, which I may say did appeal to the anti-tank people and in the support weapons wing.
Well, what sort of things would you do then? Could you describe some of these unconventional methods?
Just booby trapping mines. I'm just trying to think back now. Of all the things we used to do, remotely detonated mines, how to survive, how to build your trenches so that you could be underneath the tank and then get up from behind. There were the usual things like grenades, the 75 grenade that was used during the war, which had a sticky quality. You could put that on the tank. And it was a range of things like that, using up-to-date equipment. I would need to have my lecture notes to go back to that period, to that sort of detail. But I know it was quite good fun. Mm-hmm.
So how did this change your work then when the JDSC was organised and the Combined Arms Tactics Wing disappeared? Did that make a difference to your commitments? And
it did and it didn't. I mean, my commitment to the platoon commander's wing was always there.
Yes.
The company commander's wing, again, was a slightly bigger emphasis on that. And then again, that began to change towards the end of my stay with an emphasis on combat team operation rather than purely company commanders.
Sounds like a reversion to combined arms then, from pure infantry.
Which we had already been doing in the All Arms Tactics Wing. Which
yes.
I may say great chunks of that material went straight to the Junior Defence and Staff College. A lot of the lectures I gave to the All Arms Tactics Wing were essentially those I was giving to the Company Commander's Wing. And they doubled up. I would do my field defences lecture and then demonstration. It would be almost identical for the company commander's wing and the students in the All Arms and the Junior Defence and Staff College. That obviously would change and did change as the idea of who would go to the Junior Defence and Staff College and who would come to the company commanders or the combat team commanders course in due course was always changing and developing. But essentially what I gave some lectures, they came complete with their own sapper instructor, who's a friend, happened to be a friend of mine, and again they had their own armour, gunner and so on instructors with them. But where I had a lecture all set up, which was tailor-made for them, that was fine. A lot of our presentations, cloth model exercises, were perfectly suitable at that stage for the junior defence and staff course, and we used those. And so I played a part in those.
Did the courses spend most of their time in the classroom and lecture theatre, or did they go out on the ground a lot? And
a great deal of the time out on the ground. Mm. There were a tremendous number of field exercises in the Salisbury Plain. So it was a nice balance between lecturing of field defences, for example, demonstrating equipment for field defences, and then they would have to go out in the field and dig. Usually with we had a trenching machine, which was quite effective. We taught them explosive devices for speeding up trench digging and so on, and they actually had to put those into practice, particularly in the platoon commander's division. But they had defence exercises, a day attack, night attack, exercises of perhaps a couple of days involving a dummy river crossing, where they would have to show how they knew about demolition guards, formerly close bridge garrisons, that was one that I would be umpiring, for example. I also provided all the battle simulation for all the exercises. I had a sapper warrant officer who was a combat engineer, and the demonstration battalion assault pioneer platoon, which was commanded by a sergeant in those days, but effectively under the command of my sapper warrant officer. And we had set drill for providing all the battle simulation, so that when I sat in the exercise control, I sat next to the gunner. And the fire plan came through, and we had prearranged where the charges would be in the ground, but they were fired at the right time and as near the right place to fit in with the fire plan, to be realistic.
Simulate a bombardment.
That's right. Mm. I also incorporated movement light, artificial moonlight, which I had used in Korea. And we had down to one TA squadron in London, movement light. And they didn't have much of a role. They went across to Birwa, I think, every second year for their exercise. They tended to do a lot of military demonstrations, sort of royal tournament style of things, with
yes.
searchlights doing this and that. They were delighted to be able to come down to Warminster regularly for the night attack exercise. Their directing staff, TA staff, would bring the staff down, and they would come down in cars and things, change into kit, and then get on with it. And we practice artificial moonlight to assist them at night, either by reflecting off clouds or horizontal beams, depending on the weather conditions.
Would that be to give a direction?
Direction and light.
And
yeah.
light.
Again, you had to be careful how you use those, depending on the situation. But all these things we managed to do to try and add something different to the exercises.
Were the exercises opposed?
There were troops on the ground, yes, but they were skeleton.
Would this be part of the sort of demo troops from
it was
the
your demonstration battalion, yes, would perform that function. Mm.
I mean, when they were doing these exercises on the ground, were they commanding each other?
Yes.
Because they didn't have real soldiers to command.
They would have some of the demonstration battalion to make up section platoon numbers to give them something to do.
Mm.
But by and large, they took their turns to be platoon commander, company commander, or battalion commander, whatever, depending on the level of the exercise. Mm. But everyone was... It was all done by... classroom thing on, say, an attack. Then it would be syndicate discussion. Then there would be a cloth model showing how we went about it, and then they had a syndicate discussion afterwards, and then they would put it into practice with an attack by daylight and an attack at night.
But did they have all the phases of war? Was there an emphasis on any particular phase or aspect?
There was the battalion in defence, attack, day attack and night attack were the ones that I remember most. I don't recall an exercise, a withdrawal on the ground, but we certainly did cloth model exercises on that. The river crossing was incorporated, because there weren't any rivers in Salisbury Plain. We had to make one and put a bridge in. But that was done by discussion and a cloth model exercise. But where possible, the cloth model exercise was followed up by one on the ground. And on that, students were obviously assessed.
Did you use helicopters at all during the course of these practical exercises?
Yes, in daylight, yes. Mm. You know, they were used as much as... In following up our discussions, we used them. There weren't many of them, but they were available. But again, the troop-carrying ones had to come from RAF.
Yes. Did you use chutes as part of the training process?
Yes, they were used a little bit. The platoon commanders did. I didn't get too much involved in that. That was basically the instructors. Yeah. We were called in to when it was all arms scenario. But for chutes, they relied on their own directing staff. Particularly, that was the junior defence and staff course.
Thinking back to it and to your own previous experience in Korea, we mentioned the helicopters coming in and there being discussions about their impact. Apart from that, had there been any fundamental changes in tactics that struck you since you'd been in Korea?
Oh, the use of armoured personnel carriers, and all the developing range of wheeled and tracked armoured vehicles that were just coming in. I mean, we'd always had a few scout cars and recce vehicles that were armoured, and we had the Cambridge carriers and the earlier Bren carriers, universal carriers, which weren't very good. But there was at last coming in a range of tracked and wheeled vehicles that were thought to be effective and efficient, and they were quite well armed with weapons that could do serious damage to other armour. And again, the use of those, how far you would take the vehicles, troop carrying and support vehicles, how close you would get them to the start line, for example, from the forming up place, and then what would you do with them afterwards? The empty vehicles had to be put in a secure place so that they could be available to be brought forward again. How would you use the vehicles that had a weapon that was of sufficient power and accuracy to support you in the attack and defence? What you would do with those? That was coming in quite markedly. And of course, as the range of support vehicles like that improved and increased, so did the thought that went into their tactical use. That was always in the background, and ideas were always coming in and changing.
Now, there seem to have been two ideas about the use of personnel carriers. One, that they should simply be a battlefield taxi cab.
Yes.
And that at least the assault should be on foot, perhaps with supporting fire from the taxi. And the other idea adopted by the Germans, that the personnel carrier should actually be a fighting vehicle and should drive right onto the top of the enemy position.
Yes.
Do you remember what the thinking was about that controversy at the time?
It was coming more and more to getting them closer to the objective, if you like. Mm. And thoughts were developing on those lines. And we had pointed out that the Soviet army that then was had a great range of personnel characters, mostly